The following podcast is part of a certified educational activity titled Exploring the Evidence, Improving Cardiovascular Outcomes and the Role of Weight Loss Pharmacotherapy. Access the entire activity and complete the post-test at peerview.com/MVU860. Downloadable slides and practice aids are also available.
Hello, this is Michael Linkoff from the Department of Cardiovascular Medicine at the Cleveland Clinic in Cleveland, Ohio. Welcome to this educational activity focused on recent research presented at the American College of Cardiology 73rd Annual Scientific Sessions on weight loss pharmacotherapy and its impact on cardiovascular outcomes in people with obesity. This activity is part of an educational curriculum on this rapidly developing topic. You can access the full curriculum at peerview.com/obesitycvd. Our goals for today are to appreciate the cardiovascular impact of obesity and the need to prioritize its management, to summarize the relevant data on anti-obesity medications and their cardiovascular effects presented at the American College of Cardiology 73rd Annual Scientific Session, and to integrate these data into cardiology practice when providing care to patients with obesity. The presidential advisory presented at the American Heart Association meeting in November of 2023 identified obesity as a key central causative factor in the development of cardiovascular disease, metabolic disease, and as a key driver of cardiovascular risk, impressing upon the viewers the importance of specifically targeting management of excess adiposity, dysfunctional adipose tissue, as a means of early intervention to prevent progression to metabolic risk factors, chronic kidney disease, diabetes, cardiovascular disease, and congestive heart failure. This central importance of obesity, overweight, and dysfunctional body fat highlights the importance of the new therapies that have been and are currently being developed to address not only the excess adipose tissue, but also the cardiovascular and metabolic downstream effects of dysfunctional adipose tissue. Focusing first on congestive heart failure, as perhaps the most important trial in this field presented at this meeting was the STEP-HFpEF diabetes trial, focusing on patients with overweight and obesity and diabetes who have heart failure with preserved ejection fraction. As some background, Dr. Picard of the Brigham and Women's Hospital at Harvard Medical School presented a study from the Paragon Heart Failure Study, which showed consistently that abdominal obesity, assessed by weight-to-height ratio and to a lesser extent by body mass index, was clearly associated with increased risk of heart failure hospitalizations and cardiovascular death, and also all-cause mortality. Such that when adjusted for other comorbidities, there was no evidence of the so-called obesity paradox, which has been seen in some prior studies with the suggestion that higher BMI was actually conferred some degree of safety. But there was a clear association, and particularly with the weight-to-height ratio, which is clearly associated with abdominal obesity, of increased risk in patients who have HFpEF. Dr. Gangavelli from Emory University School of Medicine in Atlanta presented a retrospective cohort study of over 3,000 patients with HFpEF and diabetes who were matched to controls based upon whether or not they were receiving semaglutide, and showed that heart failure hospitalizations were substantially reduced, 1.74 lower in those patients receiving semaglutide. Lower rates of requiring intravenous diuresis, over a twofold decrease, and although similar, all-cause hospitalizations. So a retrospective analysis suggesting a clinical benefit in patients with HFpEF who are receiving semaglutide. The important finding, of course, from the randomized trial presented at this meeting was the STEP-HFpEF diabetes trial. Mikhail Kosiborod from Kansas City presented this important trial. This was a follow-on trial to a trial previously presented at the European Society of Cardiology meeting that trial, the STEP-HFpEF trial, had studied patients with heart failure with preserved ejection fraction and overweight or obesity who did not have diabetes, and had randomized those patients to semaglutide and versus placebo. This trial, a companion trial, randomized patients with similar baseline characteristics, but those who had type 2 diabetes. All patients had ejection fractions greater than 45% and a clinical diagnosis of heart failure with preserved ejection fraction. They all had a body mass index of greater than 30 kilograms per meter squared and were randomized to standard of care for their heart failure, but superimposed upon which was semaglutide at the 2.4 milligram subcutaneous once weekly dose versus placebo. The primary endpoint of this study was the KCCQ-10 clinical summary score, the quality of life score, and a co-primary endpoint was body weight, and confirmatory secondary endpoints were six-minute walk distance, a hierarchical composite expressed as a win ratio, and changes in hsCRP. Of the 616 patients enrolled in the trial, 44% were female. They had a median body mass index of 37. 64% had stage 2 or greater obesity with a BMI of greater than 35. There was a high prevalence of inflammation, as noted by a median CRP of 3.7 milligrams per deciliter. The median ejection fraction was 57%, so this was clearly a group of patients with HFpEF. And New York Heart Association class 2 was present in 72% of patients. At baseline, and as background therapy, these patients were very well treated for their underlying heart failure. 80% were using diuretics, ACE inhibitors, ARBs, or ARNIs, and 83% were on beta blockers. Importantly, 35% of these patients were also using SGLT2 inhibitors. So again, they were well treated for their underlying heart failure syndrome. The co-primary endpoints, as I noted, were the KCCQ-10 clinical summary score and body weight, changes in body weight. For both of these, semaglutide was associated with significant improvement in both of these endpoints. So for the KCCQ clinical summary score, the estimated difference was 7.3 points over the one-year follow-up, with a substantial reduction in body weight, 6.4 percentage point placebo-corrected difference in the two treatment groups. There were also reductions in A1C despite well-controlled glycemia at baseline, and no changes or no increase in the risk of clinically significant hypoglycemia. With regard to the confirmatory secondary endpoints, the six-minute walk test difference was substantial, with a 14.3-meter difference in the six-minute walk test placebo-corrected. And then by the stratified win ratio, which was a composite of the various endpoints in a hierarchical fashion, there was a significant difference favoring semaglutide for all of the components. The clinical events of death or heart failure hospitalization were very infrequent, very small numbers with this small trial, although the trends continued to favor as well semaglutide for the trial. I had noted earlier that this was a group of patients who had a high prevalence of inflammation as signaled by a high sensitivity CRP, and semaglutide was associated with significant reduction in the CRP levels over the course of the study. There were some limitations, of course, in the trial. The percentage of Black patients was lower than what had been reported nationally among patients with HFpEF. So there's some limitation in terms of the trial's generalizability. And of course, this trial followed patients for 1 year, whereas a HFpEF is a lifetime diagnosis. On the other hand, the effects of semaglutide do suggest persistent improvements over the time period tested. And the expectation could reasonably be that if patients were maintained on semaglutide with the persistence of the weight loss and the metabolic improvements, that they're would be durability of the effects on the endpoints, although this can't be presumed. Most importantly, this trial was not designed nor powered to evaluate events such as hospitalization or urgent visits for heart failure. This would require, of course, a much larger clinical events trial, but nevertheless, these findings for all of the surrogate endpoints and the quality of life endpoints were quite consistent. Moreover, they were quite consistent with the previous trial that I had mentioned at the beginning of this, that is the STEP-HFpEF trial, which had been presented in August of 2023, with very similar improvements in the KCCQ score. The body weight reduction with the patients with diabetes in this trial was less than in patients without diabetes in the other trial, which is consistent with the general literature trials of the GLP-1 receptor agonists. But overall, these findings were very similar among patients with or without diabetes who had overweight or obesity and who had heart failure with preserved ejection fraction of important reductions in the consequences of in terms of quality of life and functionality of heart failure with preserved ejection fraction. So this consistency provides reassurance that semaglutide is an effective option across with a very favorable safety endpoint across a broad population of patients. It improved outcomes also importantly, regardless of whether or not patients received SGLT2 inhibitors in subgroup analyses. One could argue that a trial performed now in a more current era may have a higher use of SGLT2, but the expectation based upon the subgroup analyses in this trial was that we'd see similar benefit. And the trials in particular combined suggest that the mechanisms of benefit with semaglutide do extend beyond the weight loss itself. There was less weight loss with the patients who had diabetes in this current trial as compared to patients who did not have diabetes in the prior companion trial, and yet very similar effects on the quality of life as assessed by KCCQ and on the functional improvements as well. So it suggests other effects beyond weight loss, direct effects perhaps on decongestion, vascular, skeletal muscle, mitochondrial function, epicardial adipose tissue, and inflammation. So overall, a very important study, in particular taken in the context of the companion trial presented last year. In other studies focusing on the cardiovascular outcomes related to atherosclerotic consequences of overweight, obesity, metabolic syndrome, and cardiovascular disease, Dr. Anwar of the Houston Methodist Hospital did an analysis of plaque volumes from the Miami Heart Study. This was a study in which there was measurement of calcified plaques, non-calcified plaques, and total plaque volumes across patients, and there was a clear correlation with increased waist circumference and increased waist-to-hip ratio, measurements of adiposity, of increasing non-calcified plaque volume, whereas there was no difference among the different body mass index groups with calcified plaque volume. So suggesting that there are different relationships between mechanisms of developing plaque as related to overweight, obesity, and the metabolic changes associated with overweight and obesity. And so also suggesting that different therapies would be effective in reducing atherosclerotic burden in patients dependent upon their primary pathogenic mechanism and whether or not that reflects the metabolic derangements associated with overweight and obesity. Dr. Ostrominski from the Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston presented a study looking at real-world evidence of anti-obesity medication use between 2018 and 2022. They showed a substantial uptake, particularly between 2020 and 2021, in the proportion of patients who were receiving anti-obesity medications. They looked at about 19,000 first-time prescriptions, and they increased substantially over that time period. The agents that increased most notably were the GLP-1 receptor agonists, semaglutide and liraglutide. And such, by 2022, these constituted the vast majority of the anti-obesity medications, with a small proportion of patients receiving naltrexone, bupropion, and phentermine topiramate. With regard to who was prescribing these medications, they noted that virtually the vast majority of these were being prescribed by primary care physicians, primary care practitioners, or weight management practitioners, who also a proportion by practitioners who are endocrinologists, but very small number were actually being prescribed. 0.76% of the anti-obesity medications were being prescribed by cardiologists, even as recently as 2022. So this provided some impetus here to understand the different practice patterns and also the educational needs and the comfort needs to allow cardiologists who see many of these patients to begin to prescribe these medications for patients who would benefit. There are a number of anti-obesity medications that have been approved historically. Several of them at various time points have been removed from the market, other medications not shown on this slide. But there are agents that act centrally, naltrexone, bupropion, phentermine, and topiramate, and phentermine. These agents have modest effects on weight loss. Of course, the real change in the management of overweight and obesity has come from the data that's derived from the GLP-1 receptor agonist, initially developed for treatment of diabetes, but shown to be potent in the reduction in body weight. Liraglutide and semaglutide are approved for weight loss, and tirzepatide recently, the dual receptor agonist, has been approved as well. And of course, there's now in the pipeline a variety of newer drugs that have different routes of administration or act on multiple receptors or different analogs. Of course, it's going to be very exciting to see where these arise now in clinical practice over time. With regard to the GLP-1 receptor agonist, the cardiovascular benefits are likely to be related to both indirect and direct effects. Indirect from the standpoint that these agents have effects on renal function, on reduction of blood pressure, reduction, of course, in body weight centrally, reductions in inflammation, improvements in glycemic control, and even coagulation. But also there are direct effects with receptors in myocardial tissue and in vascular tissue. And so effects on local inflammation, local ischemic injury, glucose uptake, LV function, smooth muscle function, et cetera. And so there are likely multiple effects which may explain the cardiovascular benefits seen with these agents. Relating to follow-up for the groups of patients that were studied in the SELECT trial. Just as a summary, the SELECT trial demonstrated that some overweight and obesity are key pathologic drivers in the progression and incidence of cardiovascular disease, and that kind of these are modifiable risk factors. In that trial, patients who were randomized to semaglutide versus placebo who had overweight or obesity and pre-existing cardiovascular disease, but who did not have diabetes over a mean follow-up period of about 40 months, had a significant 20% reduction in their risks of the composite endpoint of cardiovascular death, non-fatal myocardial infarction, and non-fatal stroke. So event rate of 8% versus 6.5%. So real-world studies looking at the generalizability some of which were presented at the this meeting provide important information about who and what patients potentially benefit. Dr. Blood from the Brigham and Women's Hospital looked at over a million patients at the Mass General and Brigham system between 2018 and 2023 who had a body mass index of greater than 27 a kilogram per meter squared. Of those, 81,000 had a diagnosis of cardiovascular disease that would make them eligible, and 48,000, so about 50%, actually met all of the criteria for SELECT trial. So this is an important finding. It suggests that of patients with cardiovascular disease, pre-existing cardiovascular disease, a large proportion, near 50% or more, would actually qualify based upon the criteria that were needed to enroll in the SELECT trial and would potentially benefit from semaglutide in reduction of their cardiovascular burden. Dr. Manabolo at the UCLA Lundquist Institute in California looked at effects of GLP-1 receptor agonists on epicardial adipose tissue as a means of trying to tease out some of the potential mechanisms of benefit of this class of drugs in patients who are treated for overweight and obesity. In this study, of patients who underwent non-contrast cardiac CT at baseline and 12 months follow-up after being randomized to semaglutide or to placebo. They showed substantial reductions in the volume of epicardial adipose tissue and increases in the density of epicardial adipose tissue. Both volume and low density of epicardial adipose tissue has been correlated with increased cardiovascular risk. It's felt to be inflammatory and to promote progression of atherosclerosis. And so they showed direct findings that suggest a benefit of semaglutide GLP-1 receptor agonism on the epicardial tissue, on the epicardial fat, which may be promoting cardiovascular disease. Dr. Zhou and colleagues at Fudan University in Shanghai looked at the consistency of benefit across both cardiovascular and renal outcomes among patients with diabetes who had been treated with semaglutide in two trials. They pulled data from the SUSTAIN 6 study and the PIONEER 6 study. These were both trials of patients with diabetes who were receiving semaglutide, one the subcutaneous and the other trial of the oral formulation of semaglutide, and then looked at the uniformity of benefit. Now, this is in the diabetes population. But they showed in that population that regardless of the baseline BMI, so patients who had overweight or obesity or patients who did not, regardless of whether or not patients had had prior revascularization or not, and regardless of whether or not they had pre-existing cardiovascular disease, myocardial infarction or stroke, or whether they were had risk factors for cardiovascular disease, so secondary versus primary population, across all of these different subgroups, they saw similar improvements in cardiovascular outcome with semaglutide. As well, in the trial SUSTAIN 6 that looked at the renal outcomes with a renal composite and nephropathy composite, they showed a uniform effect, regardless of the subgroup, on the improvements in the nephropathy outcome. So this was important, although in patients without diabetes, we're focusing on patients with overweight and obesity and with pre-existing cardiovascular disease in the one trial that showed benefit, the SELECT trial. This shows, at least in the patients, the population of patients with diabetes, there's a very uniform effect, regardless of the other pre-existing characteristics, that is, whether or not they have overweight or obesity, whether or not they have pre-existing cardiovascular disease. Several of the abstracts looked at the disparities across social determinants of health. Dr. Philip at Houston Methodist Hospital in Texas looked at the outcomes in terms of premature mortality by social determinants of health as well as obesity and showed an additive or effect of both of these characteristics on premature mortality, showing that in a registry of 136,000 participants, that mortality rates were consistently higher among patients with socially determinant of health, a high social determinant of health burden, particularly with patients who had both a combination of higher obesity class and higher burden of social determinants of health. And so emphasizing the importance of not only affecting or treating the obesity and overweight, but also a more holistic approach to address social and clinical risk factors to fully mitigate the premature mortality in individuals who have these combined risks. In another study, Dr. Taha from Houston Methodist Hospital in Texas looked at the mortality and risk and social disadvantage as a relation to the severity of obesity. And so they looked at patients who would have qualified for semaglutide treatment, either on the basis of overweight or obesity, as in the SELECT trial, that is those who had atherosclerotic coronary disease and a BMI greater than 27, or who would have qualified based on the presence of diabetes associated with atherosclerotic coronary disease. So in this survey of patients who had ASCVD, they were classified then as those who did not have obesity or those who had obesity and showed a clear increase in the prevalence of the risk factors. Patients with higher obesity classes were more likely to be non-elderly, female, non-Hispanic, Black, and a higher burden of unfavorable social determinants that were clearly linked to the severity of their obesity in all of these studies, again showing the more holistic approach of recognizing that obesity and the severity of obesity and overweight is accompanied by many of the social determinants of poor health. Another look at the real-world outcomes, also from the Houston Methodist Hospital by Dr. Avenatti, looked at real-world degree of weight loss in patients who were receiving a GLP-1 receptor agonist, in a group of patients who had type 2 diabetes, in a group of patients who did not have type 2 diabetes, who were receiving, presumably for the overweight or obesity indication, and it demonstrated that, in fact, the real-world reduction, the magnitude of reduction in body weight, seems to be lower than much of what we had seen in the clinical trials. So in a group of 21,000 patients followed over 46 months, 58% did have weight loss, but the average reductions were in the range of 7 to 8% up to 12 months. And of those followed over 12 months, about 18 to 20% had a greater than 10% weight loss. 4% had a weight loss of greater than 20%. And interestingly, in this study, patients who were treated with diabetes had a greater degree of weight loss than those who did not have diabetes, which is actually somewhat different from what had been seen in the randomized trials. And so one can postulate many potential reasons for this, including the issues of compliance, which could not really be assessed in this, the uptitration protocols, the rapidity of the uptitration. So real-world outcomes, clearly implementation of the findings of clinical trials to achieve the optimal effects in real-world outcomes clearly is something that requires attention as well to have optimal outcomes in these patients. With regard to optimal outcomes, Kevin Lee at North Shore University in Evanston, Illinois, looked at a pharmacist-driven program for uptitration of GLP-1 receptor agonists or SGLT2 inhibitors and showed actually a great success with this approach, with 80% of patients reaching their target doses for both the GLP-1 receptor agonist and the SGLT2 inhibitor groups. As expected, about 15% of patients had to stop their medication for side effects that have been predictable. But this is showing ways of implementation that can optimize the outcomes in these patients. There were also abstracts looking at the newer agents, the multiple receptor agonist, tirzepatide, which affects both the GLP-1 receptor as well as the GIP receptor. One study presented by Dr. Sethi demonstrated that in a pooled analysis of 10 randomized trials, that tirzepatide consistently reduces blood pressure by substantial amounts. The highest dose, 6 millimeters of mercury, which is clearly a range that would be expected to improve cardiovascular outcomes. In another study of a tri-receptor agonist, 3 randomized controlled trials of retatrutide showed substantial reductions in blood sugar, A1C, and body weight, and also substantial reductions in blood pressure, 5.7 millimeters systolic, which again would be associated, we expect to be associated with substantial improvements in cardiovascular outcome. So a lot of excitement with regard to some of the newer agents that are being developed and have not yet been shown in cardiovascular outcome trials to reduce cardiovascular events. But thus far, for all of the biomarkers and all of the risk factors associated with cardiovascular disease, we would expect substantial improvements. So from the standpoint of applying this to our clinical practice, data continue to emerge, expanding on the observed benefits of GLP-1 receptor agonists on biomarkers and outcomes that are related to cardiovascular ischemic events, heart failure complications, and kidney function in patients with diabetes and or overweight or obesity. And while the mechanisms of benefit remain incompletely defined, there is growing evidence of physiologic effects beyond weight loss or glycemic controls. These positive outcomes in patients with cardiovascular disease have spurred tremendous interest in the development of novel agents with multiple receptor actions and specificity, routes of administration, and durations of action. And of course, the major challenges remain in expanding access and affordability, to those larger populations who would benefit from these agents, particularly those with higher social determinants of health burdens. So this concludes our discussion for today. I hope you found the activity informative and useful in your practice. I also encourage you to participate in the other two activities that are part of the cardiometabolic crosstalk curriculum. Thank you very much for participating.
This activity is certified by PVI, Peerview Institute for Medical Education. Remember to download the slides and practice aids. Thank you for listening. Download materials and complete the post-test for instant credit at peerview.com/MVU860. This activity is supported by an educational grant from Novo Nordisk Incorporated.